On March 1st, Bombshell recorded a live show at the Carlucci National Security Symposium, hosted at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. War on the Rocks members can listen to the Q&A from the event at the Warhol.
All right, welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Warren DeYoung-Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And for those who are listening to this podcast later on, we are live at the Carlucci National Security Symposium at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. So thanks to Sanford School and to the Carlucci family for sponsoring this and bringing us down. It's actually been kind of a fun afternoon already, and we've got more events ahead of us. When we do kind of these live shows, and we'll talk a little bit about the podcast and introduce ourselves here in just a second, but when we do the live shows, we move off our kind of normal format. So we're not going to do White House mayhem or keeping up foreign relations. We have kind of a broader set of questions to kind of dig into, which is fun for us too, because it takes us off the news cycle and we don't have to like pay attention to what happened in Vietnam this week. And it's a little bit easier. So why don't we start with introductions? Radha, go first.
So I'm Radha Iyengar. I have a PhD in economics, and I currently work in Silicon Valley, but my backstory is that I used to be a regular old-fashioned academic and then somehow decided to go on a boondoggle to Afghanistan, where I stayed for many months and met Erin Simpson. And from that went into the U.S. government, where I worked at the Department of Defense and then the National Security Council and then the Department of Energy before being very, very tired and going to work at RAND for a while. So, there you go.
I'm Lauren Shulman. I started off as a presidential management fellow at the FBI for about 5 minutes and realized that the FBI was not for me at the time because, as it turns out, it was not like the X-Files, or at least not very much like the X-Files.
You are sort of working some Scully hair these days.
Yeah, it looks pretty good. Yeah. So I went over to the Department of Defense in 2005, 2006. This was in the middle of lots of things going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was a busy place. I stayed there for the next several years working in the policy office, ultimately working for Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. Moved over to the National Security Council for a couple of years, went back to DOD for another, it felt like about 5 minutes, but about six months or so, and finished my government tenure at the National Security Council again, working for Ambassador Rice as her senior advisor. I was also very tired and moved to California for a year, came back, and now work at a think tank called the Center for New American Security. Erin.
I'm Erin Simpson.
If you can't see, Erin's wearing a KU.
I do have a Jayhawk. It's a little talisman. It's going to keep me safe here. I have a PhD in political science, and I happened to write a dissertation on counterinsurgency campaigns about 30 seconds before that was the thing that everyone was talking about. I taught Marines at Quantico for a couple of years, and then, as Radha said, spent a year or so in Afghanistan as a counterinsurgency advisor. When I came back from that, a friend of mine had started a company that was doing a lot of data science work for DARPA, but focused on kind of these complex, irregular conflicts. And so I led that project and then ran that company, which we sold in 2016. And now I work in the defense industry and do a variety of kind of industry acquisition-y kinds of things. So we've got lots of different parts of the national security space, but not all of the parts of the national security space covered here. And let Lauren tell you a little bit about the podcast, and then we'll kind of launch into our bit.
So we started, our first podcast episode was in January of 2017, and we came up with this idea in November of 2016.
Allegedly, not all of us remember this conversation.
Well, I was going to get to that. It was at a happy hour, and I believe Radha pitched this idea to Erin and I that we should start a national security podcast. And this happy hour was a post-election happy hour, and there was a lot of wine and champagne and other things consumed for a lot of reasons that we won't get into. And Erin and I were like, yes, podcast, that sounds amazing. And a few days later, we engaged Radha, and he said, what? But we decided to keep
on. But it was
on.
A really good idea at the time.
It was a great idea. So War on the Rocks, which is a fantastic website and resource on national security issues, was a huge fan of ours, but also a great promoter of ours in helping us set up our first podcast. And what it has eventually evolved to is a way to talk about national security issues from an insider's perspective, but explaining it to everyone else, that all the lingo that we use, all the ways that we are kind of do ridiculous things, all the questions that we have that we don't really fully explore in the news cycle week to week, we try to get it behind, kind of give people a behind the scenes look of how national security works, while also trying to be as entertaining as possible, sometimes succeeding, sometimes failing. We usually have a cocktail of the week, which is why at 3 p.m, we are consuming some very fine craft brews that we have been provided from our hosts here. We're quite excited about. This is the 4th or 5th live show that we've done,
something like that.
And like Aaron said, we do these a bit differently, but we'll try to start off with a
icebreaker
kind of question that we get, that I will let you initiate.
So we've done this for some other audiences before, but we're going to have each of us give you a sense of if we had to reform, fund, or kill.
Slight variation.
Reform, fund, or kill. Please note the alliteration and use of syllables, if you will. Federal agencies related to national security. And I think Lauren usefully said that they must have seats on the National Security Council to give us a little bit of flavor here. Which would those be? So, Radha, do you have answers?
Should I start with reform?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to go with Department of Energy in my reform bucket.
Oh,
okay.
Lovely.
Nice. So we used to, when I was there, joke that the Department of Energy was in fact the Department of Everything. And it had a real hodgepodge of, you know, real hardcore national security issues, including maintenance of our nuclear arsenal, as well as a range of domestic issues related to things like electricity pricing and managing how electricity generated on national lands gets priced and distributed to the utility industry in the United States. Right? And everything in between, including funding and maintaining basic science in our national labs. And it just seemed like we could do some reforms.
No, she wants to reform. Are you reforming or
funding? I'm reforming.
You're reforming.
Yeah.
So okay. What do you want to fund?
Oh.
You didn't think of that one?
I didn't. Come back to me.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you for kill too, just FYI.
Right.
I thought I just had to pick one.
Okay. That I will do all of mine at one time. I would like to reform. We have our prior speaker still in the room. I just want to make sure. How awkward will this be or not? I want to reform the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Because I think they have a lot of, they're sort of like, basically they're not unlike a happy hour where you get together and you talk about really interesting things and you're going to save the world and you have lots of great ideas, and then it doesn't matter very much because you don't actually have any power at your happy hour. I would like to fund the Department of Defense. We can talk more later on about that.
I have questions.
Okay. And I would like to kill, again, with like no offense to our prior speakers, USUN as its own kind of separate entity within the Department of State. It should be just part of the Department of State and not have grown to it's not ridiculously large size, but it's a little bit of a large size given its role. All right, Aaron.
I think I would reform the Department of Defense.
Okay.
I would fund CIA?
Interesting.
Okay. Question mark?
Okay. But you don't know how much money they get right now.
Exactly. Now you see where I'm thinking.
All right.
And if I were, if we're really killing.
Oh my gosh, Aaron, are you going to say it?
I think in the same spirit as like the influence is just sort of outsized and it needs to be brought back in line. I think USA just has to get like brought back into some other orbit.
All right. So. Did you come there up with
your Okay, I did. Okay. So for fund, I'm going to go not terribly controversially with the State Department.
Sure.
Which I feel like we can talk more about in our substantive section on how we think about risk. Mm-hmm. And for kill, with all due respect, and it's not that the underlying functions can't be reorganized in some way, I'm going to go with DHS.
Okay.
Interesting. So great. We've all worked ourselves out of future administration jobs with those answers. That's
yep.
Good work, team.
So let's continue in
so
that
it's
vein.
On that vein. Exactly. So for this first sort of segment, and we're going to kind of talk amongst ourselves for about the hour mark and then open it up to you guys, and we'll do a whole range of questions, whatever you want to talk about, policies or careers or Star Wars, whatever, and KU basketball. The first section here, though, is, you know, what debates do we want to see the presidential candidates have? What foreign policy debates do we want to see the presidential candidates have. And that could either be within the Democratic primary or in the general election. And I think this is sort of born from a bit of a frustration with the 2016 election process, where I think Afghanistan was mentioned sort of once in the presidential debates. Climate change was hardly mentioned at all. But, you know, what are, I think we all have kind of a feeling this is a pretty heady moment geostrategically and for U.S. foreign policy in general. And so what are those meaty issues that we want to see the candidates debating somewhere in, you know, the next 2 years? This election in 2020.
Oh, God.
Who wants to start?
You go.
Okay.
All right.
So I will go and sort of, in some senses, riffing off our icebreaker, which is what I'd like to debate is how we should think about risk. And what I mean by that is,
I just want to remind you that Radha is an economist. Yep. So this is a
I'm definitely not going to talk about trade-offs or incentives right now. So I think, you know, we've seen sort of iterations of different strategies where we have more forward-leaning diplomatic corps and they're in places that are exposed and they take on risk. And we have incidents like Benghazi and a host of security incidents at embassies. And we've seen situations where we have smaller forces with smaller footprints and much more complicated rules of engagement and taking on risk and frankly, taking on lives again, like in the cases of using special operations forces in a range of areas, including West Africa. And so I think at the end of the day, we have this idea that we want to be more forward-leaning and more expeditionary in some places for some purposes. We want to not do it with a heavy footprint because we think there are costs to it, but also we don't want to like have people get hurt and we want partner forces, but we also want our people there to do our
security. Yeah, we want a good,
interest.
Fast, cheap sports car, right?
I mean, I want a pony, but I think in the spirit of thinking about where we should be both prioritizing funding, but also prioritizing what our national security strategy is, I think we need to be defining what are the different risks and what risks do we find acceptable and what do we find unacceptable? And then let's talk about trade-offs and what we need to do to make that happen.
Yeah, it's a good answer.
I'll try.
My turn? Okay. I have two, but I'll be brief on them. My first is that I would like the candidates to debate what they think alliances are and what they are for. And we got close to this in the last election.
Won't that just freak the allies out?
Yes.
I think they're already
freaked
out. Any
more?
Yeah, non-unique.
It's a good non-unique answer. So maybe this is, maybe we somehow managed to have debates that are like only shown to America. Yeah, that's not going to work. Okay, but no, seriously, in the last election, we got close to this because President Trump came awfully close to, well, not even just awfully close. He talked about like, what is the whole purpose of NATO? They don't pay their dues. There are no dues for NATO. Let's just clear that up. They don't pay their fair share. Why are we in South Korea or Japan? And these are reasonable questions if you start at the original question, which is what are we having these alliances with these countries for in the first place? And who is included in that group? Because there's always countries that are included in that group that are a little surprising to a lot of folks sometimes. But kind of getting to like, what's the purpose of these? Why do we have allies now? Are the original assumptions we had about alliances still the same? And do we need to modify these arrangements in any way? My second question, and Aaron will like this one, and they will hate it because none of them will understand it, is I would like to hear about what they think a cost-imposing national security strategy or grand strategy would be.
Like kingdom for a cost-imposing strategy.
Mostly because, for the most part, whenever any of them can manage to talk about national security, it's that
they wanted the candidates,
yes. They want to do more things. We will do these things and these things and these things and these things. Also, we may cut back on military interventions, maybe, unclear, depending on the candidate. But it's not really clear how our adversaries or competitors are going to react to those things. Are our adversaries and competitors, are they happier? Are they sadder? Are they going to have to spend more? How much money are we going to have to spend to all be doing more of these things? I would like them to think about what are they creating with their strategy? What is the reaction our adversaries might have?
You mean like incentives?
And is it going to bankrupt us to actually pursue it?
And would it bankrupt anybody else to try to challenge it? Right.
Right.
I mean, that's the strategy part of strategy is the interactive element as opposed to just like a Christmas tree of things you'd like to do with your national security agencies. And you can tell obviously if these are all debates that we understand are not going to happen, right?
Right.
I mean, this is definitely in the magic fairy dust land. So the debate that I would like to see some number of the candidates have is whether they think deterrence works. Because I think that your underlying assumptions about whether nuclear deterrence works or conventional deterrence works actually then drives a whole bunch of other policy decisions. If you think deterrence works, like at a metaphysical level, that drives a certain set of preferences about what to do about North Korea. If you think deterrence works, counterproliferation is less important than safeguards or other sorts of things. If you think deterrence is actually quite fragile or that escalation is or miscalculation is quite likely, you might have a different set of policy preferences. But there's a really fundamental question about deterrence that we don't talk about in public policy forums for the most part. And I was certainly not raised on this either as an academic or as a practitioner. I know all three of us really worked the war on terror for the first decade of our careers, but this
now,
strikes me.
I did a PowerPoint brief on how to deter terrorists.
Good.
And it was amazing.
Excellent.
How to deter and dissuade terrorists.
I wish I knew what the icons were. I hope they were like little Lego Hezbollah men.
They were not, but I want to go back and find it.
Yes, that would be outstanding. Yep. My sort of second-ish question, and it's, I think, related to that, is similar to sort of Lauren's, but it's sort of, what does it mean to be competing with China? What are we competing for? For to do what? For influence, for economic access, for, because it strikes me that this is sort of not an ideological competition in quite the same way as the Soviet Union. It's not exactly a military technical competition in the way the Cold War was either. So if we're competing with China, what are we competing for? And how do you do that under conditions of globalization? You know, what does it mean to do that with highly integrated economies, really integrated supply chains, not just for us in China, but for us in China and everybody else who might be invested or interested in that process? And, you know, that's just one of these sort of, again, it's not quite an underlying question. It's a forward-looking question, but the nature of that competition is then going to drive, you know, which agencies you want to, you know, reform, fund, or kill.
Yeah, and also probably how you want to trade off different parts of that competition between economic and military and diplomatic tools that you have and what your relative advantage is in trading them off, right? China has very different ability to trade off between economic and political tools than we do in many cases, and that might matter, or it might not.
And it goes back onto the allies question. Mm-hmm. And the allies, our alliances are a really unusual source of advantage, I think, for the most part, in American foreign policy. And it's underappreciated, really, what that brings. But it's not without, I mean, it brings constraints as well, right? I mean, it's our nuclear force posture is very much informed by our security guarantees to our allies, for example. And that's, again, not something that we hear in sort of the day-to-day defense debates or national security debates in Washington.
Okay, so moving on to our next segment. So we were trying to figure out how to frame this and realize there are a lot of ideas that in foreign policy, national security, that we are frankly all really tired of hearing about, either because we think that they are wrong or maybe that they are right, but never actually going to happen. So could we just stop talking about them in any way? I thought about having just like a list that I carried with me to meetings and handed out to say like, we're just not going to mention these. And like, we can all agree to not mention them and move on to the next harder topic that might have some real possibility.
Professor Gentleson had one in the last segment, which was a Marshall Plan for anything.
Exactly. Yes. So I have a million of them, but I wanted to ask you guys, what are policy proposals or ideas related to that you don't want to hear about ever again, or just want to stop having conversations about ever again, because maybe they're not realistic or they just are awful.
So I can kick us off with the, let's make the Army like blank. You can pick. Let's make the Army like our development establishment and have them do society building. And, you know, that'll work out great. It doesn't, guys. It doesn't work out great. Let's make all of the Army
really hard,
like a special operations force.
Yes.
I mean, because what could go wrong with trying to scale up over no time with limited training, a group of people to be very specifically tactically trained? It's going to work perfectly. It also doesn't. And I think maybe we could like have the Army be like the Army, have the other things be like the other things, and then talk about what the relative uses of those different military and non-military tools are. And how we should use them and when we should use them and what the right funding is conditional on the capabilities instead of just trying to make
the Army.
I'm such
an economist about this.
Just let the Army be Army. That's all I'm saying.
Well, then, as we were discussing earlier, then you run into the problem of what's the Army for? If not that, what is the Army for?
I mean, this is part of this problem of the Army, I think, recognizing its profound vulnerability on a modern battlefield, especially major combat operations battlefield. And so trying to find a different or adjacent niche to push itself forward.
And I think having itself. A debate on the core functions of the Army and what they should focus on is a totally reasonable discussion that I would love to have in greater detail on both what that means for force sizing and for like things like personnel policy.
We're really popular
retention.
If you guys hadn't invited us to all their favorite meetings.
Yeah. We're so interesting.
Aaron.
So the discussion that I'm sort of tired of is a focus on like the top line budget for the Department of Defense, you know, like overall, how much money we were spending, too much overall or not enough overall, and how that basically just lets us elide what we're doing with the Department of Defense. And so this is particularly true at the moment, I think, or will become increasingly true as the Democratic candidates all kind of race toward lower and lower numbers. You know, we can do it for 650, $600 billion, $1, Bob, right? That's a Price is Right joke. And I don't know, like, again, with these other things, you know, for to do what? And so the discussion about, it's not quite roles and missions, but it's a little bit broader than that on, if you think, as a point of departure, that we are spending too much money on defense, and that is a reasonable position to hold. What should the department? You can't just, you know, you can either like make a wholesale cut and say, this is the correct number, now reset. Nor do I think it's effective to sort of salami slice and sort of, you know, carve out small things in small places. That's not going to get you very far either. So what is it you would like the department to do differently? Like that's the, or better, or custom, you know, have a cost imposing as opposed to we impose all of our own costs,
right?
Sort of strategy. But I think that we're just sort of fixated on these top line numbers without having, again, sort of the policy debates, the position debates that go underneath that.
And that's, I mean, going back to our prior discussion, that's the thing I worry about in our presidential elections. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier for any candidate to say we should add $50 billion to defense or that we should cut $100 billion from defense. And they, in a political campaign, there's no rationale for them to follow up on that. People might ask them questions like, well, what would you cut? Or what would you add to? And they will probably say like, oh, well, force structure or readiness. We'll come up with some random term. But that doesn't actually mean anything. And they've now then boxed themselves into a policy that has real implications that doesn't make a whole lot of sense from like, why are we doing this to begin with kind of perspective.
I mean, related to that, I would, despite my desire to have cost imposing strategies, I could do without ever hearing about offsets again.
Oh, come on.
First, second, or third, fifth, 12th, whatever number we're on or aspire to have.
But we are now being offset, Aaron. This is the new offset hotness, is that we are being offset ourselves.
Yeah, we are 100% being offset, but we could just find some better terms. People actually understood what that meant to us, which is that we're spending gajillions of dollars and not getting very far strategically.
I spent 3 years trying to figure out what it meant, and if you do away with it now, I will be extremely unhappy. All right.
Here's Lauren.
Okay, mine... And again, with no offense to our prior speakers, I am extremely tired of hearing about how we need to have a comprehensive approach, interagency coordination reform, beyond Goldwater Nichols for the interagency,
whole
of government solutions. It's not that I'm against these. I'm very much for these. I think everyone is for them. But there appears to be some idea in many people's heads that there is a structural or institutional solution that will make all of that work and be better, whether it be that we create an agency for strategic planning or that we get rid of the National Security Council or that we have more meetings or less meetings or that we create incentives for people to rotate around to different agencies.
There's some one meeting invite to rule them all.
Right, exactly. That like somehow if we just read that Project for National Security Reform and implemented it, it would all be okay. And I very much subscribe to the theory that the National Security Council and the national security process works exactly as presidents want it to. And that if it's dysfunctional and it's frustrating for people, the president is pretty well aware of that and just going to go along with it. And even if you create new institutions or new meetings or fewer meetings, we will somehow find a way to make it even harder for ourselves. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, but it does mean that maybe we should stop writing massive reports on this that are not probably ever going to be implemented in any way, and think through what are the things that we might be able to fix, whether it be human capital or security clearances or the number of emails I get in a day. If somebody could fix that, that would be great. I am a very pro interagency coordination person who is just tired of hearing about how we could just solve it, everything would somehow be better. Next segment, Radha.
Yes. So sort of taking a slight step back from the specific policy debates on any individual existing national security, particular part of the government, I was thinking a little bit about sort of what are the big issues, sometimes boring, often meaty, definitely complicated, that we should be thinking about in a more sort of expansive way across sort of government, business, private sector, various parts of the national security apparatus to help us kind of move forward on major issues that we're not tackling enough. So outside of our standard national security bureaucracy processes, our Valentine moment, what are the things we should be talking about?
The processes are a Valentine.
I mean, there are processes to be had there. There's different ones.
I guess I have a really narrow one and then like a really big one. I don't know how to make them talk to each other exactly. So the narrow one is honestly could be an answer to Lauren's question as well, which is like security clearance reform. Mm-hmm. Folks here have clearances or have had clearances, right? Mm-hmm. It's super irritating. This Jared Kushner situation sort of revealed today, makes my head explode. I ran a company, and like running a company that maintains classified contracts and classified information is like times 1,000, like what you do for maintaining your personal clearance. So I have a lot of PTSD on the issue, but it's also the case that like there are clearly some things that could be fixed, including decriminalizing marijuana, which would go a long way toward making this an easier process for a lot of folks. But the other kind of big picture answer I have is we think about industry or sort of other non-governmental actors, is how do you make national security issues real to them? I mean, how do you convince the private sector of the urgency, you know, across any number of domains, right? You know, energy, Silicon Valley, manufacturing, of the urgency that those of us who sort of sit in these offices feel. And you know, we were sort of talking before, you know, the way that, you know, if you work at, you know, Google or Exxon or any number of these companies that have really integrated supply chains, that have really diverse workforces, that have offices, you know, around the world, you're actually, your day-to-day looks really different than if you work in Washington, where you don't talk to foreign nationals, where you have highly compartmented communications, and like where you're focused on America as America kind of all of the time. In the 1950s, that probably wasn't that, it was probably very different. Ford Motor Company, right, in the 50s, well, first of all, it's run by Robert McNamara, but, you know, probably actually does look a lot like many Washington offices, even before McNamara changed those Washington offices. That's not the case today. And so I'm sort of flummoxed to figure out how you meaningfully or credibly communicate, you know, why companies should value, privilege, you know, U.S. security concerns over, one, any other country, or two, their economic interests. Those are hard cases to make, and we've sort of lost the muscle movement on how to do that, especially for companies that are staffed and built and distributed very, very differently than they might have been historically.
All right. My soapbox that I get on frequently, and if you've heard the podcast, you've heard me get on the soapbox before, is that if I was elected president in 2020, one of the first things that I would do was issue some kind of emergency declaration, which apparently is the new hotness these days, on our national security human capital personnel system. And there's a lot of reasons behind it that are related to this administration, but also our broader problems that we've created for ourselves over the last several decades. Related to this administration, there is a higher attrition rate in our national security workforce than has been true for a long time. At the State Department, in OSD policy, in the intelligence community, and elsewhere, we're seeing people leave at senior and mid-levels at rates that are, one, not really easily replaceable from the people below them, but then also are not easily replaceable to bring in people from the outside. But more broadly, we have set up our national security personnel system, and not just national security, everything in the federal government, to assume that you are going to be hired as a fairly junior person and you're going to stay in the federal workforce for like 20, 30 years, if not longer than that. And you're never going to leave. And that you might, there are opportunities to come in at more senior levels and to temporarily come in as, you know, a technology professional or as a lawyer or as a human capital professional on a short-term basis. But for the most part, those are all just Band-Aids on a larger problem that will not be solved by adding more and more Band-Aids. There, if you join the federal government right now and you wanted to go work in Silicon Valley for a couple of years to gain additional skills, which is something the federal government says it needs, there's not a great mechanism for you to go leave and do that or for you to come back. Theoretically, it's possible. It is just not really practical in so many different ways for a lot of reasons. And so in my view, if you want to bring in the skill sets that we claim that we desperately need in federal government, we want to adapt to the career paths that we see much more frequently these days, which is changing jobs every year, every couple of years, or even changing career fields. And adjusting to the fact that, frankly, national security is not very attractive in a lot of ways in a way it was 10, 20 years ago, we have to fundamentally redo everything. We have to be able to hire back all the people we're losing. We have to be able to give people flexibility on where they work from, when they leave, how they come back.
We have to not report every single foreign contact.
But yeah. We have to let people maybe smoke weed every once in a while and get a security clearance. We have to allow for not everything needs to be so highly classified that you have to work in a SCIF constantly. You have to think about people being young families and maybe can't work 80 hours a week at the National Security Council, even if they want to work there and are valuable. There are a million ways that we could reform our national security personnel system. And people, when they hear me talk about this, say, like, this is the most boring thing ever. No one's ever going to care about this. Well, that's great. In like 10 years or so, you're going to realize that you didn't hire people for 3 years at the State Department or at DOD, and that the people you want to hire now don't really want to work there, or that the people that you want to retain there have realized they're going to get paid a lot more if they go work at Facebook or Google. This is a challenge that we're not really worried about right now, but if there's a major national security crisis and the personnel you want there are not in place, you can't suddenly bring them on board. They're inaccessible. So I would make this a crisis for anyone who wants to listen to me, and my soapbox is now ended.
Well, Radha. I will see your crisis personnel and raise you a critical infrastructure discussion, because who doesn't want to talk about infrastructure more?
I always do.
I mean, so here's the thing. We in the government think a lot about securing all sorts of facilities. Lauren mentioned SCIFs, where we look at classified information. We have lots of equipment and material.
Right.
Not SCIFs. Those are nice too.
What does SCIF stand for?
Secure compartment information facility.
All right.
It's the most generic thing possible.
Yeah.
A place where we do the secret stuff.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, places where we store things we want to keep safe. We have backup systems for our key buildings. Like, you know, if you were in a government building and the grid went down, you might have a backup power generator. We haven't really thought through a lot of the infrastructure that, like, we as a society need for our day-to-day lives that isn't at all in any way owned or managed or operated or even thought about by the federal government or even state governments. Like, I don't know, power things, right? Like the electricity grid, power stations, substations that can black out major parts of the country, or telecommunications infrastructure. And we think about it in a
really good Wired article about this, actually, on like 5G. And we don't have a there's no like US company that's trying to compete with Huawei on 5G.
Right. And we
Huawei or the highway. God, I love that.
Sorry, Radha, continue.
That's okay. There's always time for puns, guys.
Yep.
you know, we haven't really thought a lot about how we secure or deal with the critical infrastructure to the 5G point. We don't have a real backup plan if the infrastructure we need to like communicate and operate goes down. And occasionally we have to deal with these in one-off crises. Superstorm Sandy, there was no electricity and people tried to go to the gas stations to put gas in their car to leave and couldn't pay with a credit card because there was no power. So they could pump gas into their car, maybe. Okay. Right. But they can't pay. And now what do you, right? Like, and so there are just a lot that you get to locations where there's a hurricane and there's civilians and non-emergency personnel that are going to be mustered to try to help deal with it. They don't have a way to communicate with each other because they don't have the backup radio systems and they want to use cell phones, which are not currently working. So there's a whole range of different ways in which we have critical infrastructure. And we have sort of crisis response systems, but we haven't really had this conversation on like, hey, should we be talking with different parts of the energy sector, with different parts of the telecommunication sectors, thinking about backup plans for internet or 5G or, you know, fill in the blank on your favorite technology that you find indispensable in your life? How do we want to have a backup plan for that? How do we want to deal with making sure it's diversified? How do we want to make sure the people that are or companies that are investing in it are investing in a way that's consistent with our national interests? And, you know, until we start viewing the privately owned critical infrastructure as critical, we're probably not going to have those conversations. Also, we should come up with some kind of snazzier term. No, Lauren already stole my national emergency, so I don't know what I'm going to do.
I had no idea that you liked critical infrastructure. I feel like I'm seeing you in a whole new light right now. It's just like, I feel like I know all of the things you're obsessed with and that we've added another.
I wasn't that worried about it until I went to the Department of Energy. And then it turns out it scares the bejesus out of you when you realize where all the electricity substations are. And you're like, well, geez, probably do something about that.
This is actually a major problem when you work in the national security field is that like you have a narrow subset of things that you worry about on a day-to-day basis. And like, keep you up at night, maybe you give you anxiety. And then suddenly you change jobs and you add more. Like right. It never quite goes away. And like I feel as though there should be an entire field of psychology purely devoted to this issue. Speaking of advice.
Yes. Okay. So before we turn it over to you guys for questions, I thought we'd go sort of down the line and say, you know, kind of what is our advice to current graduate students and or you know, how does our grad school experience relate to kind of our current profession? There's a lot of debate around, you know, the relevance of various academic fields at the moment, sort of in an angsty, useless sort of way. But there's, I don't know. I mean, Radha may feel a little bit differently, but I feel like I use my, like, actually, like, even when I'm doing the most banal PowerPoints, I'm almost always doing something that is deeply related to my underlying training in political science. And so I actually feel like I use my PhD every day. So yeah, what advice do we have to recent graduate students or sort of a story of how our grad school experiences relate to our current professions?
Well, if you've heard me say it once, you'll hear me say it again, which is learn how to do stuff with data. Yeah. Take a class, read a book, be able to understand what a statistical estimate is, how to interpret it, when it's being used correctly, when it's being used incorrectly. People have this weird idea that you can lie with numbers. You can also lie with words, guys. People do it a lot. The reason people can lie with numbers is because nobody understands them or takes the time to understand them. If you're in grad school or you've recently graduated and you don't know basic statistics, just stop right now. Go out and buy a book. I think like a couple of years ago on one of our Christmas lists, I recommended a bunch of books. I'm serious.
You did.
Read them.
Yep. She recommended Naked Statistics.
It's good. It's very readable-ish. conditional on being a statistics book. But seriously, like think about it. Be able to understand where the numbers come from and what they mean, and more importantly, what they don't mean and what other information you need. I would say there's not a day that goes by that that underlying training of being able to not only understand, like, here's what a regression is, let me show you, like, statistical convergence. I almost never use that.
You don't need, like, neural networks. You just need a regression.
Yeah.
Right.
Almost all the time.
Yeah.
But being able to look at the numbers and actually speak in a normal human way about what they mean and don't mean is incredibly valuable, both for you understanding what is happening in the world around you and for you being able to explain what it is you think to other people and respond to what they're critiquing.
Lauren.
That's good advice. I should take it. Let's see. So I think the most valuable thing that I learned both in undergrad and graduate school that I apply every single day is how to write very briefly, succinctly, and to the point for people who do not have time to read what I am writing. I have never been at any point in my career the smartest person in the office or the person who knows the most about a certain subject in a particular portfolio, like not once, but every single time I've made an advancement in my career, it's been because I volunteered to write the memo, or I said that I would, you know, take point on coordinating our responses, or I just happened to be the person who could get my point across the best in writing. And that has won me more friends and influenced more people than pretty much anything else has. The ability to actually nail it in one page or even like a couple of sentences. Here's what I'm actually trying to do. This is why I love Twitter. As anyone who follows me on Twitter, I love Twitter. I can never give it up. It is just part of my soul.
Tells you a lot about
but,
our soul.
Yes, exactly. But seriously, like you don't, there are no opportunities to be taught to write in life unless you're actually doing it in a school setting. And when you're doing it in a school setting, most people like are annoyed by it. Like when your professors are saying, this doesn't make sense, you need to back this up, or please clarify. Like that gets really old after a while, so you stop listening. Nobody does that for you later in life, or if they're doing it for you, they're doing it because they're going to get rid of you in some way. Like this memo is terrible. I'm never going to ask you to write a memo again. You don't get that chance back. You're getting a chance right now to learn these skills in a way that you don't when you're in a professional setting. The other advice I give to people is that my initial like big job in Washington was because my grad school roommate introduced me to somebody who connected me with somebody at the Department of Defense, and I got that job. And every single job I have gotten since has been like just a path from that. Your grad school friends and really to the national security community overall is sometimes weirdly and strangely collegial, like, but and everything happens because of networking. That doesn't necessarily mean that's a good thing, but it's true. So be nice to the people in your classes. God knows what they'll be doing in 20 years. Maybe they'll be in jail. Maybe they'll be national security advisor. Who knows?
Maybe both.
Maybe both. Happens. But you know, keeping in touch and being nice to one another is always a good thing. My favorite boss ever gave me the advice, always be the nicest person in the room and you will always have a job. And he happens to be a very smart person who I want to be in the room and to be able to give policy advice. But he has always applied that, like, I'm just going to be the guy who's smiling and making jokes and like polite to people. And it's worked out very well for him. Thank God he's also intelligent.
That has not been my career path.
That advice is sometimes different from men and women. And we can talk about that if you want. Yes.
So I'm trying to think, I don't know if I have any like super grad school specific advice. One of my mantras, for advice is do your job, not someone else's job, not the job you want to have. Do your job. Do your job first, right? And then if you find you have like just an incredible amount of spare time, maybe other things that you find yourself, you know, engaging in, but your performance will be evaluated on the things you were asked to do. Do them. Do them very, very well. Do them competently and do the sort of duck thing where you're paddling ferociously under the water and you're, you know, the response back when asked to do something is not 15 reasons about how complicated that is. The response back is, you got it. And then you go make it work. A different version of that, and it's a little bit trickier to do when you're first getting started, but it's actually really important after the first couple of jobs, comes from one of my favorite people, which is never forget you're interviewing them too. So when you're interviewing for a job, I was debating at some point sort of just like really how much of myself to be in an interview, which is a lot. And he's like, I don't know. Like, never forget, like you're interviewing that. If they don't like it, you don't want to work there, right? Now, again, you can take that a little too far. At some point, you actually have to pay your rent. But there is an element of, there's an element of fit. There's an element of, do you want to work for these people? And that's probably something that we don't ask ourselves quite enough as national security professionals, both at an interpersonal level and at a policy level. And so, you know, never forget you're interviewing them too.
All right. Here you go. You've been awesome.